Hello, hello, hello. It's Ari Rosenbaum, soon to be joined by Dan Venturi from Brightworks, and welcome to another episode of that 401k podcast, the podcast like no other, the podcast that could. This week's episode, we're going to talk about the wonderful world of MEPS. Yes, we are going to talk mainly about the multiple employer plans, the history of what Dan and I have tried to do in the business, a noted advisory plan union that cost us a lot of money back in 2012, as well as the new guidance, the executive order that was signed by President Trump, and the soon-to-be-released regulations. We know that the Department of Labor did hand them out to the Office of Management and Budget. So we should be getting a proposed regulation very, very soon. You may even get it in time when you're listening to this broadcast. So we're going to talk about that, as well as what we've been doing in the week, and some of the other exciting, fun and exciting things in the 401k plan business. And here we are with our good friend, the co-host, as we, we'll make him out to be, Dan Venturi from Brightworks. Dan, how was your past week since the recording of that first episode together?
It's been good, Ari. It's wet. I didn't realize when I moved to the northern shore of Long Island that it was a reasonable proxy for Seattle. I think it rains every other day here.
Yeah, it's been pretty bad, and if anybody knows the story, I live in Oceanside, and we got killed by Hurricane Sandy, so I got a sub pump and a French drain, and they're constantly, I record the episode where my office is downstairs, and, you could hear the water just, like, being pumped out, so it's, as long as there's not 5 feet of water downstairs, we're okay, so.
Agreed.
Let me see, my week it was pretty interesting, it was kind of funny. On LinkedIn, I'm friends with the guy who's the head of Steiner Sports. Not Brandon Steiner. Brandon's just, the chief executive, but the chief operating officer. And he was offering suite tickets for the Mets. And he offered it up to people on LinkedIn. And I commented, I'd love to go. My son's a big fan, of course, and whatever. So Wednesday night, we went to the game, DeGrom's last game. We were in the suite. He tried to make it like a good networking event, which, of course, I forgot to bring my business cards and when I had my son there or watching the game, whatever, but it was a lot of fun. And, of course, back at home, everybody else was upset that I didn't have tickets for them to go to the suites. And, I feel like sometimes it's like first class on an airplane. Once you go first class, you don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the Seinfeld thing.
But you can't go back. It's
yeah, exactly.
Dramatic.
But I will have to say the suite at Citi Field, there are other tickets called the Hyundai Club tickets, and the Hyundai Club tickets are kind of like a suite experience, except it's a bigger room. But at least at the Hyundai Club, the food's better. You got like 50 different choices. You get a hot dog, you get a slider, you get like 5 or 6 different menu items. They got like an ice cream thing, and a while back I got tickets for that, and that was a lot more fun. But obviously, seeing the DeGrom pitch and what's probably going to be a Cy Young award winning season was a lot of fun. And then some of the other interesting stuff, it's kind of funny, like today with my interactions on Twitter, I'm wearing an Eric Dickerson jersey today. So of course I tagged Eric Dickerson and he retweeted my tweet that I was wearing him today. And, I put in a question to Jim Ross on, from the WWE, the former announcer. He had a podcast, so he actually asked one of my questions that I had concerning the UWF and the old territory days in the 80s. And he kept on mispronouncing my name, my last name. So he's like, Ari, you owe me some money. So then I tweeted him this morning. I said, tell me where I should send the money. And he says, oh, we're okay. So that's my interactions with, fame this week.
Do you remember back in the day, wasn't it Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone that used to do the TBS broadcasts and the NWA?
Well, I know Jim Ross from, the UWF. In Brooklyn, we didn't have cable until 1989. There was a channel in 86 called U68. And they had the UWF, they had the NWA, the World Class, everything on at 7 o'clock at night. Yep. And then eventually the Home Shopping Network bought the channel and that was the end of it. But that's how I first started watching Jim Ross and the UWF and all that stuff. But then we got cable, and yeah, you would listen to Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone. My daughter and I met Jim Ross along with Jerry the King of Lawler at one of these wrestling conventions. So it's kind of funny to go back and do that. So, and the other update is that this podcast is now available on iTunes. So we've hit the big time. If you have an iPod, you have an iPad, you have an Apple TV, which of course I like own all those things. You could simply subscribe on iTunes. They will notify you when a new episode is up and available. So at my house, you'll see the three on my Apple TV, the three Conrad Thompson podcasts, the one with Bruce Pritchard, the one with Tony Schiavone, and the one with Eric Bischoff, and then you'll see the picture of our podcast. So it's kind of funny, but I refuse to listen to it because I hate the sound of my voice. But that's been going on for 45 years now. So,
but we should consider doing Ari maybe set up some sort of. I don't know if you could do it through your Twitter handle or if we should get a separate one for folks out there to comment. Reach out, see if they want to send in questions.
Yeah, we should do that. It's just the matter of getting another Twitter handle and managing three different Twitter handles, but I think we can do that. And, I did ask, and it's always good to go on LinkedIn and ask if people have any questions. That's always fun. And, yep. If I mispronounce people's names, they'll owe me money too, like Jim, like I owe Jim Ross.
There you go.
So we're up and away, and, we're going to be a big deal. Who knows? People, maybe they'll throw in some advertising dollars.
Yeah, future's so bright, we got to wear shades. Right?
So, again, why don't you plug your company again, since we don't have any paid advertising, and since you're doing this out of your free time.
So we're Brightworks. We can be reached at 1-866-316-7326. Or on the web at brightworks with two X's.com. We are a full service TPA/standalone 316. If you listen to our last podcast, a big thing that we do that separates us from the field is we take on liability for the payroll as well. So we are a true 316 in every sense of the word. So we look forward to hearing from you guys out there, a few advisors. Are in need of a 316, it's critical that you bring in the right people. Ari says this all the time, and we agree with him. It's your client. They'll come back to you guys if something goes wrong. So you want to make sure you have the right people, on the wall there with you, looking over your clients.
Sure. And let me plug my things, the RosenbaumLawFirm.com, that 401ksite.com, that 401k conference. We will be at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia on Friday, November 9th. We're going to have it's a good, fun event. Right now we're running a $75 early bird special for advisors to attend. You get lunch, 4 hours of content, a stadium tour, and a meet and greet with Larry Anderson, who is a former Philly and a current radio voice, as well as Tommy Lasorda's good friend, the Philly Fanatic. So we hope that you join us for that. Dan and I will be there. So that's at that 401ksite.com/401kconference. You could see that. And we're working on some other events for 2019. And once we solidify that and we haven't scared away every plan provider sponsor out there, we'll talk about that. So this week's episode, we're going to talk about the wonderful world of multiple employer plans, what it is, our experiences with them, and really dealing with two, big things that happen with MEPs. And the first thing was the 2012 advisory opinion. Well, I always have my two cents on it. I'm very opinionated about that. And then we'll talk about what's been going on with President Trump a few weeks back signing the executive order calling about for the reintroduction of open MEPs as a single plan. And the Department of Labor this week dropped off their proposal at the Office of Management and Budget. So we may get some proposed regs within the next couple weeks. I thought it would take 6 months, but I guess, Trump, who really doesn't speak softly but does carry a big stick, I guess the Department of Labor decided that, maybe now they should issue something because they haven't for 6 years, which we'll talk about. So first things first, a multiple employer plan is a plan adopted by multiple employers that are not connected to each other. They're not part of a control group. They're not. There's no common ownership. These are individual employers that that participate in the plan. You know, the idea is you have a plan cooperative. You group every the small plans together. You get better pricing, and you know, I have to say, it took me a few years as an ERISA attorney to understand the difference between multiple employer plans and multi-employer plans, which are pension plans. I always got the two concepts confused. It actually took me about 2 years as an ERISA attorney to figure that out. So, Dan, what was your experiences before the you know, before May 2012? A date, if I would remember, I think it's May 7th, a date that will live in infamy.
But, very true.
Yeah. So, when did you first hear about multiple employer plans, and you know, what'd you think of them? Because I have a funny story about that.
Probably a little bit before the advisory came out. We looked at it. I mean, it was back in my consulting days, and we kind of looked at it as panacea might be a strong word, but as a really favorable solution for a lot of our clients. We were dealing primarily with private equity firms, and the idea was to start something specifically for them, right? Drive savings, obviously, through the aggregation of a bunch of plans. And it turns out that was the origin, the original origins of 401k Reboot and Brightworks, our two platforms. It was original, and you know this. I mean, you wrote the opinion letter for us way back when. And it was a little bit after the advisory letter came out, but the letter that you wrote went a long way with our internal management and letting us establish the firms. You know, so that's something that's indelible in our history. You know, like I think everyone in the industry, we wish that advisory letter never came out.
Which we'll talk about. But first, my experience with multiple employer plans, you know, I spent 9 years as an ERISA attorney for these two TPAs, and we didn't have clients that had them. You know, I knew what they were, and I think my first introduction to them is we handled the DC office of a very well-known not-for-profit. You know, they do a lot of good work or whatever, and I was very working over there, I had a lot of contact with the clients because, you know, I helped them with a lot of the problems that our administrators would cause. But anyway, one day she called up and she was interested in maybe offering their DC office 401k plan as the genesis of a multiple employer plan because they had all these different regional offices that had their own plans. It seemed like an interesting idea. And she was really gung-ho for it. And one of the things that I realized from my experience is that a lot of people are very gung-ho about multiple employer plans. They love the idea about it, but the idea of actually getting adopting employers to partake in it, that's a hard bargain. And it doesn't really work. It's not so easy to get employers to adopt a multiple employer plan. So she goes to her boss and says, oh, you know, we're going to have this national conference. It's going to be in Boston. We'd like for you to be there. And, you know, my boss is like, okay, you know, I'm an ERISA attorney. He was an ERISA attorney as well. He says, you know, I'll go. And, of course, would you help sponsor the luncheon? And, you know, he doesn't want to sponsor the luncheon because, you know, it's kind of like a pay-for-play. You don't know what you're going to get out of it. And he felt like, I guess from his experience, he was through that where, you know, he put in a couple dollars for sponsoring something and didn't get anything out of it. And of course he does sponsor the event and nothing comes out of it. And then when I was at that law firm, that semi-prestigious law firm that I always joke about, I had clients that were, a 338 back in the day, 10, 12 years ago, when people really weren't doing that, they were doing index funds, and they had me look at this dairy cooperative 401k plan. That was a multiple employer plan, and it was with one of these high cost insurance providers, and with one of the expensive consulting companies, not anybody that you worked for, but it was just, they were paying through the nose in the fees, and they tried to shake it, but I don't know who was related to who and whatever, but they never got out of it. And you know, multiple employer plans, you know, my experience, I really didn't get a lot until I started my own practice. I worked with a QPA in Atlanta that really was gung-ho about the multiple employer plan business, and because of that relationship and relationship that I had with Terry Powers, who sells the Platinum 401k out of he has that a MEP that he runs out of Tampa, because of that relationship and knowing him from 401k recon events, that was my only time speaking at FI360. I think I'm on the list. I think I'm on the do not speak list. I haven't been back since. I think that's it's about 7 years ago. So we did a whole thing on MEPs, which was great. So I had this Atlanta TPA. They were going to change the marketplace and offering this great, great MEPs. He was going to offer a DB MEP, a defined benefit MEP. He had Marsha Wagner, draft, an opinion about 403B MEPs. Everything was going to be great. But this guy had, I think, ADHD. He couldn't really get to going. He had all these relationships, a lot of good, good providers. Everybody was gung-ho. And as 2011 was getting into 2012, in May 2012, the Department of Labor issues an advisory opinion regarding MEPs, regarding a specific MEP. That's the TAG MEP. And that was in May 2012. And they said, you know what? If there's no commonality between adopting employers, no nexus, and there's not really an employer. We'll talk about the opinion and my thoughts about it. You don't have a single plan for 5500 purposes. And the beauty of the MEP was, there'd be a single 5500. And if you take that out of the equation, what do you got? And it really shook up the industry. You had a lot of providers who put in a lot of effort into that area of the business, and they had a tough time of adopting it. And then you saw a lot of the TPAs and a lot of advisory firms, just really shy away from it because of the concern about it. But it's interesting that prior to this guidance on this regulation that they're going to put in place because of the Trump executive order, the Department of Labor has never explained when there is commonality or any type of guidance for a open MEP, a MEP where there is no commonality or nexus to operate as a single plan. So that really, hurt us. We were working on something together. That hurt a lot. So when you heard that, it's not like the shot heard around the world, but it was probably the shot heard around the MEP world. So Dan, when you found out about it, how'd you deal with it, and, your thoughts about it, because I have my two cents.
Yeah, like I said, I don't think the folks at TAG expected what they got. I think they were trying to, they were expecting to legitimize the industry, so to speak, and the DOL threw them a curveball. In terms of how it affected us, we pivoted and focused more around, like you said, the nexus. Private equity portfolios were a great source. At least we thought it was a great source. But to your earlier point, folks don't like to be forced into things, and providers don't like to provide pricing unless they have assurances. So it became a chicken and the egg situation, where we couldn't really get the pricing that we wanted to attract the clients we needed. So we were able to get two in place. We still 316 on those two. They run as expected. They're challenges. I mean, it's like having a bunch of kids. And get, especially around audit time or testing time. There's always one or two that you gotta push along a little further. But from a plan participant perspective, they are getting the discounted pricing. So in that regard, I think it's a success. We'll see what the future holds. I think the big criticism is, how do you treat $1 million plans and $10 million plans the same, right? And that's something that I think we'll have to figure out a workaround for. But with the ultimate goal being to save participants and simultaneously alleviate, the liabilities of plan sponsors, I do think there could be a bright future here.
Yeah, you know, going back to the 2012 advisory opinion, again, that was TAG, that they were, I think at the time, a $1 billion 401k plan, and they had an ERISA attorney in the Midwest who was a real big MEP expert and was defending the MEP process and the MEP model. And he went and sought the advisory opinion. Now, you know, it's very easy for me to second guess what he did, but I always will second guess what he did because, you know, in college, I was a college Republican, and there was still to this day a conservative leader who trains conservative politicians and students. It's the Leadership Institute, and Morton Blackwell has this philosophy, and his rule number one is never give a bureaucrat a chance to say no. And that's been my biggest problem with the TAG plan. They wanted the blessing from the Department of Labor, but they didn't understand that, you know, I think that they might have thought that they were going to get a, you know, a seal of approval. And I just think that, you know, it gave the Department of Labor opportunity that they didn't really need to take. And that's what put us in that situation. And the TAG plan, the biggest problem, you know, when I designed these open MEPs, trying to avoid, you know, they created a plan sponsor that was just merely an offshoot of the, you know, the advisory firm. And I always thought that was a big problem. Plans got too big. And, you know, not for nothing, you know, pricing wasn't the greatest, but that's happened with a lot of MEPs. And, you know, it really mucked up the business for all of us. So, you know, it really affected us. So that TPA that I was working with, Atlanta, didn't get really into the marketplace. And, you know, my plain documents weren't, you know, I wasn't being drafted to write these things and with adopting resolutions. And eventually, you know, the guy stopped paying me. And so I actually had to file a lawsuit against them. And I have a default judgment. I still haven't been able to collect on it, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, the beauty of the MEPs was, okay, so the advisory opinion, not a lot of people wanted to draft open MEPs that would try to tiptoe around that advisory opinion, which I thought was kind of strange. I thought, you know, I said, as long as you can show some commonality, create a nexus, you'll be fine. And a lot of providers were very, very hesitant towards it. And I've been working with some association MEPs. Where you have a Chamber of Commerce. I have one in New Jersey that's really working well. And in Florida, I have a lot of MEPs in the medical practice field and whatnot. And it's been really working. But, you know, the biggest problem that I ever had with that the Department of Labor advisory opinion was, you know, 2012, that's 6 years ago. Why isn't the Department of Labor coming up with something new? You know, they came up with the new fiduciary rule. They quickly came up with regs to allow states to offer IRA-type programs, which, of course, are as popular as ruffled shirts are in the, you know, 2018. But they came up with that, but they just, you know, didn't do anything with the MEPs, even though the IRS still has the opinion that a MEP is a single plan. So they've never been able to change that, and I guess I didn't want to be the plan that got audited and fight it, but, you know, there could have been a marketplace for it. So a lot of these providers, you know, went the 316 route. So, you know, they still issued the 5500, but, you know, they became a 316 provider and still ran the one plan document and whatnot. But, you know, I just, you know, I don't know how you feel, Dan, but I felt like the Department of Labor, if they were really interested in pushing more coverage for employees, that, you know, to me, a MEP is a no-brainer.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's a byproduct of our dysfunctional government. You know, you can't get the IRS and the DOL to agree on anything. You can't get, you know, the red folks to agree with the blue folks on anything. So, you know, hopefully Trump's big stick, so to speak, will straighten some folks out. We'll get some clarity and, you know, the market will pick up on it. And I'm sure there'll be bumps. I'm sure there'll be products that, you know, are built incorrectly, but somebody will get it right, and they'll be a model for everyone to follow, and, you know, hopefully it'll be a path for all those smaller businesses, and honestly, I mean, the MEP works upmarket as well, right? I mean, there's still there might not be as considerable, cost savings because, you know, obviously there's a lot more compression on market, but there is the liability outsourcing. So there's still tremendous value there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the devil's in the details, as I say. So it's like, you know, I'd love to see what their, you know, proposed regs look like. My concern on MEPS is who will be the plan sponsor? Who will they allow? Will they allow a plan provider to be a sponsor? You know, who can partake in a plan? As history, you know, as I wrote in my last book, the greatest 401k sequel book ever, which is still available on Amazon, I talk about the story that I am the only – I was a fiduciary who replaced Matt Hutchinson, and I was the only – I was the fiduciary for the only plan that he didn't steal money from. And Matt Hutchinson is a character who had three or four MEPs that he was a part of, and, you know, from one or two, he stole $3 million. And Matt Hutchinson was a creation he did that PBS show – what's that? It's that I always forget – Frontline. They pawned him off as a, you know, a 401k fee expert, and, you know, he created a career for that, and then eventually he wanted to be a big time in Wyoming or Idaho, and he stole $3 million, so that's always been my concern. And I think the bad apple doctrine, and you know that bad apple doctrine, the idea that if you have a participating employer who doesn't comply with, you know, compliance testing or whatever, anything that, you know, a qualified plan has to maintain, that that would affect the qualification of a MEP. And they used to use that as the reason not to, you know, as the commercial against the MEP.
But you know? Can't you, I might be mistaken, but can't you write in the plan document to a degree, or insulate to a degree within the plan document?
Yeah, I mean, I always did that, that I had language in there that kind of could allow the plan sponsors to force people out. But then the advisory opinion on that tag case suggested that adopting employers needed to – I think they needed to have a say in how the plan was run, and that may have run afoul of it. But, you know, the bad apple thing to me was always this kind of fake commercial because every plan, you know, even as a single plan, you know, if you don't comply, you're going to be you could get disqualified. And sure. I've never seen a MEP get disqualified. And even if there were issues, you know, like single plans, multiple employer plans could self-correct, voluntary compliance, whatever it is. So it was always, to me, a kind of nonsensical argument against it, you know, but as you know, MEPs aren't for everybody.
No, not for everyone at all.
You know, larger plans, they don't really need it. They get good pricing on their own. And I always thought that, you know, it's also part, you know, control. A lot of, you know, plan sponsors want to give up control if they had to. And, you know, Dan, I mean, have you seen, you know, I've seen pricing on a lot of MEPs, and a lot of them that I found were not on the unbundled side. They were on the bundled insurance company side of things.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, some of the MEPs that I worked at, the ones that are successful, we started up at these insurance companies that I never wanted to be associated with, but we had to at the time because the plans were too small. So, have you seen fee-wise? Because I really haven't seen the great pricing that you would think open MEPs should, you know, have.
Well, as I said before, it's a chicken and the egg scenario. Providers, unless you come to them with a basket of employers that want to sign on originally, providers aren't really interested in providing pricing that's reflective of, you know, the aggregation. You know, their position is they've heard stories, you know, before. They've heard advisors say, yeah, he can bring in $50 million of assets between, you know, these four companies. And inevitably, you know, one company joins and the providers get, you know, that they're left holding the proverbial bag. I think what helped us, at least in the beginning, is we had as much leverage as I guess you could have with providers based on the size of our book. So we kind of had, you know, we had substantiated our position in terms of bringing in the assets. That's really the biggest issue with the pricing. You know, you have to find a partner that's willing to absorb a certain amount of the risk.
Right. I mean, you know, we, with these MEPs that I work with in Florida, I mean, we started with, in quick succession, these two insurance companies that I'm like, really? I mean, you're there? And it was funny. At a certain time, we got big enough where they just didn't want our business anymore. And they actually kind of, the last one kind of forced us out. And it was actually a blessing in disguise because I didn't want to be associated with that company. So I'm not going to mention who they are, but they're an insurance company. And then when we went to someplace else, which they started as an insurance company, but it's not part of their name anymore. And it's worked out a lot better. But yeah, that's always been my biggest concern, you know, with that TPA in Atlanta. I tried to run an open, unbundled plan. And the advisor opinion obviously killed that business. I think we had $3 million of assets. And it's just when you're not, when you haven't reached critical mass, which always reminds me when the private equity company that bought my old TPA, he talked about, you know, he was a German guy. He's like, or actually Austrian. We will go public when we reach critical mass. So when I hear critical mass, I always think of this guy. And he's like, we will go. And of course, we're going to go public very, very shortly, you know, 1 or 2 years. And then there was a credit crunch in 2008. And I think only now they went public. So 12 years later. But yeah, the MEPs don't, you know, they don't reach critical mass. They become too expensive, and my MEP, you know, once you reach 100 participants, you got an audit expense. Someone's got to pay for that, and you know, unfortunately, it could be the plan participants. And you know, with these small plans, if you have a MEP with, you know, 100 employees but not a lot of assets, it's really going to cost participants a lot of money to pay for that audit, which they might not have if they, you know, stood alone.
Sure. Like you said, it's not a, on both sides of the spectrum, right? It's not a perfect fit, you know, for really big plans. It might not be a perfect solution for really small plans. You know, like everything else in our industry, it depends. But I do think there's enough middle ground there that if the model is right, it could be beneficial to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. As with anything in this business, you know, my concern is, you know, what kind of products and services are going to be out there and the cost. Because, again, the idea of a MEP is it's like a cooperative. You know, I always use the example of out here in New York, ShopRite. ShopRite is not like a typical supermarket chain like Stop and Shop or Wegmans where, you know, one company owns all the stores. ShopRite is these individual grocery store owners grouped together and, you know, form the cooperative that does the buying, that does the advertising, and they are competitive in pricing. And that's kind of like what a MEP is. It's cooperative. One of my clients who is a TPA, we talked about running a cooperative like that, with the idea that maybe one day this is pre-Trump executive order, that we would go that way and then maybe change to a MEP when we finally allowed it. And I was it really never took off, but you know, I always said the word cooperative is a problematic. I just think in this country we have at least financially, we have a very strong libertarian streak. And I think anything that's cooperative, I think it's like a kibbutz or something like a dairy cooperative or like Ocean Spray or something like that. And they might want to avoid a 401k plan that's cooperative. They think they'll, you know, the Marxists will get their money or something. I don't know.
It doesn't sound too American, I guess.
Yeah, I he wanted to use the word cooperative. And like I said, it never really went anywhere. He didn't get the interest that he thought he would get. And I'm like, I don't know about cooperative. But he, you know, he had the experience, and it's his TPA. And if he thinks he's going to get clients, let him use cooperative. But he didn't get any, so I don't know. We'll say, I don't know. But it should be interesting what's going to happen. And, you know, they're going to be proposed regs. You know, I know a lot of providers are looking to, you know, what's everybody doing? And, you know, I think we know what we're doing, which is being quiet. I think the best thing to do is think about what you want to do, and then see what the Department of Labor will actually allow. I think any provider who's going to now offer OpenMEP is begging to be disappointed with what the regs will say. I know that feeling when the fiduciary regs came out, you know, the proposed regs on the new fiduciary rule. So we'll see what happens. It should be very, very interesting the next couple of weeks and see where we go from there. And then, you know, whether you're a plan provider or plan sponsor, it's going to be exciting times because you're going to see more products out there. Anything that promotes fiduciary issues of sound management, you know, we're all for. So we'll see what happens. So I think that we've killed this MEP thing to death, and I think this will... Any final words, Dan, before we fade to the end song?
Other than, you know, what you said, Ari, let's keep our eyes open for the new regs. I'm going to get a shameless plug in for my Buckeyes tomorrow night, beat Penn State. Go U.S. in the Ryder Cup. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay, until next week, I guess, as you know, as Dan Rather once said, courage. Bye-bye.
10 past, you think nothing really changing but the dates. You a grand slammer, but you know, Babe Ruth, you gotta learn how to relate. I may be swinging from the pearly gate. I got all the answers, and lo and behold, you got the right key, baby, but the wrong key. Ho, yo. Side of the bed, and how I got thinking about all those things you said.